Pacifico, Phil Hendry.
And it is the world-famous Phil Hendry Show here every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast and 4 a.m. on the East Coast, a news talk and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about, where truth is our bitch and where we go, where other talk shows wish they could, but they can't. And it's great to be back with you live here tonight on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Visit our website, philhendryshow.com, to watch a live streaming video cast of our show right now. And you can see us as we broadcast live here from our studios at the El Pacifico. And we had quite a bit of beautiful weather today. I hope you've been wherever you are, man. I know there's some nasty stuff happening up in the Northwest. We're going to be talking here in a moment with Art Griego from the Santa Monica Airport. He is a pilot and a contributor on matters having to do with aviation on our show, because the story, if you didn't hear it, out of Houston is quite strange, and I say that with the greatest of respect. It was a captain this time, the captain of an aircraft that was having what was described as a breakdown, a mid-air, bizarre mid-air breakdown. The captain of a JetBlue flight. It was traveling from New York to Los Angeles, and the flight was forced to land an emergency landing in Amarillo, Texas, where the captain was removed from the aircraft and hospitalized. Now, the passenger said the captain of Flight 191 was acting erratically outside the cockpit and could be heard shouting about Al-Qaeda and bombs being on board. And in other words, all the things that you just love to hear a captain of an aircraft shout. And of course, I'm being facetious. One of the passengers seated in the third row told a local newspaper that fortunately, in first class, close to the captain, was a man who was a former corrections officer. And so he had experience in restraining individuals physically, and he was able to put a chokehold on this guy and take him down, and then a whole bunch of the other passengers just sat on this guy. The co-pilot was quoted as saying that the captain was acting in a bizarre way. It was reminiscent of another embarrassing moment for the airline when flight attendant Steven Slater went down the emergency chute. I don't know if you guys remember that one. But in any event, the co-pilot said the captain left the cockpit during the flight, and the co-pilot locked the door, according to passengers. We got Art Griego on the line, actually. He's on a flight himself to Las Vegas, I think, tonight. It is a very quick jaunt. Are you flying commercially tonight, Art?
What we're doing, Phil, is bringing some passengers over to Las Vegas.
Yeah, that's what I mean. This is a private shuttle.
Yeah, that's the business that we run, my wife and I run, and we're just bringing some passengers over to Las Vegas tonight.
And did you hear the story that I was just talking about?
We did, and it's always of concern every time a fellow pilot, anytime any aircraft that involves the business that we're in, which is ensuring the safety and the travel of individual citizens, is always of grave concern when we hear that something like this happens, especially has to do with the health and well-being of a flight member.
Now, one of the things that I saw in the story that jumped right out at me was, and maybe I'm the only one, was that the airline, JetBlue, said they're not going to release any information about the pilot, not his name, not his medical condition. They released nothing today.
That is correct, because you don't want to jeopardize, first of all, you don't want to jeopardize the pilot's ability to make a living at some point in the future. I mean, you want to make sure he gets treatment. You don't want him to be unfairly characterized in the press or otherwise be unfairly characterized in a medical report that perhaps could be wrong or any one of a number of things. So I would just hasten to say to you, Phil, and your listeners tonight that this is simply something that protects the privacy of the pilot, so that he is getting the right medical treatment, so that the airline doesn't take advantage of the situation to cast some doubt on his ability, and that the most importantly, the passengers don't get a hold of erroneous information, or the public doesn't get a hold of erroneous information, and makes it more difficult for him to do his job.
We're talking here with Art Griego about Art is a former commercial pilot, about the JetBlue flight that today was forced to land an emergency landing in Amarillo, Texas, when the pilot had what was described as a bizarre midair breakdown. Let me pursue this this health thing for a moment, that is publicizing the health of the pilot. You said that you certainly don't want the public to know because it would jeopardize his ability to do his job in the future. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's difficult enough flying commercially, Phil, when you have not only an aircraft to control, but you also have to deal with the public. When you're flying and you are in the midst of doing this very, very difficult job, you certainly don't want passengers with information about the pilot getting nervous, causing problems for flight attendants, causing safety problems. Because the overall, Phil, you know, the safest person on the aircraft is still the pilot, whether or not he's had a medical issue in the past. Regardless, he is the safest individual on that aircraft. He is the man who's in charge. And if you lose him because you've got passengers who are nervous about him or are causing a problem themselves, then you've got a real problem. I have, as you know, Phil, for years, I have been campaigning to carry some kind of a sidearm or a weapon in the cockpit for this kind of an eventuality. I'm not just talking about terrorists now. We're talking about passengers who get information that should not have been in their possession, and then they begin to act in ways that are not safe.
Well, I want to follow this line of reasoning a little bit. And our number, by the way, folks, 877-876-PHIL, 877-876-7445. I don't know if we have any airline pilots out there or just people that fly a lot. You're saying to me that you campaign to arm our pilots. Now, I know that there are airlines that in other countries, I think, that allow their pilots to be armed. I also know that this has been a topic of discussion in this country, and it has not been something that it's not yet been something that has become a reality. But you're saying that you wanted pilots to be armed because of the reactions of just everyday passengers?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that we don't have a problem with terrorists. But if a pilot, if a passenger got a hold of my medical history, and you can use me as an example because I had a similar, not as bad, but I had a similar problem following 9/11 when I had been flying, I think something like 48 hours straight. I had a couple of commercial runs, and we had been setting up our own private business. I was very tired, and I had gotten on the PA and talked to the passengers, and I'd said some things that upset some people, and I got into a physical altercation. Now, if that was made public while I was flying, then there's going to be passengers wanting to come up and talk to me about it.
And that's why you feel you should have a gun?
No, I'm saying that's one of the reasons why I felt we should be armed. If we get terrorists are obviously the number one problem, but if you get a passenger that suddenly thinks he is a member of the NTSB or the FAA, or he thinks he's suddenly a cop, and they want to start to push their weight around. And
you're saying that someone would be so bold in finding the medical information, the medical background, your psychiatric background, that they try to push their way into the cockpit?
Well, I mean, I had a passenger tell me when this happened to me that he never wanted to fly with me again, and he hoped that I was fired.
Well, tell the audience what happened to you.
Again, I had a situation where I was so tired that and it happens, Phil. It happens to the best of us. I lost my perspective, control, if you want. I had a bit of a nervous situation where I frightened the passengers.
And what did you do, if you don't mind telling us?
Well, I got on our I got on the captain's squawk to the passengers, and I started pretending like I was the air traffic controller for the plane that went down in Shanksville.
And you pretended you were the air traffic controller for United 93?
That's correct. Yeah.
What were you saying?
Well, I was on the play. I was on the talkback, and I was saying United 93, United 93. Where are you? Where are you? And it was. It was a bad. It was very, very bad. I was hospitalized and had to be medicated. But I remember this one passenger saying, "I'll never fly on your airline, and certainly never fly with you again." And that stayed with me because I didn't think it was fair. And
well, can you blame the guy, though, if you think about it? Here's a guy that he's looking at laying on a cot, who's just been taken out of the cockpit of the aircraft, who was scared the hell out of everybody. You know.
Well, but again, look at it from my perspective. I've got to, I have to make a living. And if you take that information and you make it public, you know.
Well, that's what we're talking about here, and that's what we're discussing with Art Griego here tonight, folks. The pilot on this JetBlue flight, his name hasn't been released. What's wrong with him specifically hasn't been released. And I'm sure that the public would like to know, but the airline has said to protect the privacy of the pilot, and Art concurs with that. Because in your mind, Art, if the news gets out there, the pilot's not going to work again, the public will overreact, and so forth.
That is correct, because again, the pilot's the safest guy.
So there's no safety risk.
I don't think there's as much a safety risk as there is with passengers going haywire and trying to kick into the door. The pilot is still, on average, if you look at American aviation, we have the best pilots on average in the world. So you can't, but on average, let's take a look at our customers. Are they any more... I guess, are they any more stable than any other passenger? And the answer is probably no. They're just as suspect in terms...
Well, you don't have any statistics on that, though, to know that the average passenger in America...
Well, but we just know that we've... I just know that the pilots in this country are far more stable. I think in a situation where you really need to have someone thinking cool, calm, and collected, far more stable than the passengers are going to be.
All right, we're talking here with Art Griego here about the JetBlue captain tonight who was restrained today on a flight from New York to Los Angeles by the passengers. He apparently had some kind of a breakdown midair, and we'll ask Art to hang on the line with us. His name is not released. His medical condition is not released, and the airline said they're doing that to respect the privacy of the pilot. Don't you think at some point, and I'm sure that they will, but don't you think at some point this is vital information for passengers, for the public, to know whether or not they have full confidence in this airline? Our number is 877-876-PHIL, 877-876-7445. The world-famous Phil Hendry Show. Will be right back.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show. Famous Phil Hendry Show.
And our number is 877-876-PHIL, and we're talking with Art Griego, who is a pilot, retired pilot, is flying a private passenger charter service now that he owns with his family, but was at one time a commercial pilot. We're talking about a JetBlue pilot that had a nervous breakdown, I guess, of some kind in the cockpit today. Art, I wanted to find out more about this because it's strange. And if I'm a passenger, obviously that's going to concern me, you know.
Well, there's no question it concerns a passenger. There's no question at all. And we're mindful of that. I'm just, what I'm saying is, it's something I hope that people would understand. When the dust settles and the pilot has been removed or the passenger or the crew member, whoever, that obviously they're entitled to their privacy. I don't think that the company should release his name. I don't think the company should release his condition.
But don't you think that anybody that's going to fly on JetBlue...
Well, hold on. Let me just finish what I'm saying, because you're talking about something. I'm a professional, and by that I mean I'm a pilot. I've been there. I've done that. You're a member of the public, and we get confused sometimes with the public. And this is why I was talking to you earlier about needing, in many ways, to have our pilots across this country armed, as they do, for instance, in Israel. The commercial pilots are armed because the public, when it comes to flying, can panic. And when the public panics, you got a situation.
Yeah, but if a captain, if you don't mind me interrupting here, if the captain of a plane panics, the plane's going to go down.
No, it's not, because you've got a co-pilot. That's what I'm saying. But if the public, let's take the reverse of what happened on 9/11. I'm happy that what happened on 9/11 with United 93, those brave people giving their lives to, obviously, to save the capital It was an amazing event, a historic event in the history of our great country. But let's look at this more objectively for a moment. If you're an airline pilot, as I'm sure those hijackers saw themselves. Now, I'm not saying that's what they were, but I'm sure they saw themselves as the crew of an airline that they had a job to do with. And you look at the passengers and what they're capable of. If I were those pilots, and again, I'm looking at this objectively. I don't want you to think that I endorse what happened on 9/11. Not at all. But looking objectively, if I were the hijackers of United 93, and I'm looking at those passengers, I would probably want a weapon too. If they'd had a gun, or they had some actual explosive.
Well, it's hard for me to look. I mean, you want me to look objectively, and it's hard for me to do that. You know, I can't imagine a plane load of passengers behaving the way the passengers on United 93 behaved. I can't imagine any other plane load of passengers behaving that way. I think that was a unique situation born of desperation and of the crisis of the moment and the terror of that day. You know.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, if you look at it objectively, if you put yourself into the shoes of the man that was flying that aircraft, I don't know what his name was.
It's one of the terrorists.
You're absolutely right, Phil. But if you for a moment put yourself in the shoes of that man and imagine yourself as an airline pilot, you've got a problem.
Well, what airline pilot is going to have a problem like that?
I don't know, but I can tell you this much. If you begin to release the medical records of pilots and co-pilots, and the public gets a hold of these, and they panic, you're not going to have a United 93, but you're going to have a situation. And that's why I've said we need to be armed.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt you.
Hold on. Well, you are. I'm trying to tell you something here, Phil, because I'm a professional aviator. You're not. I need to be armed, and other pilots need to be armed.
In case the public gets a hold of information about your medical records that causes them to panic. I'm asking you a question here, okay? Because I think this is far more important question. You said that you are flying on this aircraft, and you know, if you're a pilot, you're flying on an aircraft, and you need to be in control, and you need to have the aircraft. It's your aircraft, okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Now you lose control, as this pilot did today. The passengers have a legitimate concern that man's mental state is such that he could endanger the aircraft.
It is only legitimate insofar if he were the only pilot, but they had a co-pilot. And on average, again, I can't emphasize this enough, on average, the average pilot is in far better mental health and in far better shape than the average passenger. That's why I'm saying that, you know, if you look at the overall, I'd be far more concerned with the passengers than I would be with the pilots.
At some point, JetBlue's going to have to release this man's name, don't you think?
I don't know. I hope they don't.
You don't. At no point do you want JetBlue to release this pilot's name?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
There's no reason.
There's no reason. JetBlue has. JetBlue should be questioned here, you know.
Yeah, go ahead. Go on. Tell me what JetBlue, because I can hear in your voice, Phil, you're not really sure what it is you want to say.
No, I know exactly what I want to say. JetBlue is the legitimate target of questions by the public insofar as their hiring practices.
Insofar as their... Why do you say that?
Because they've got a pilot that they hired that had a breakdown. So how are they vetting their pilots? How are they qualifying their pilots? Who are the men that they're bringing on board? Who are the crew members that they're bringing on board to serve the public and to get them safely from point A to point B?
The way that you describe that, Phil, and you're one of the most intelligent guys that I know, but the way you just described that there shows that you don't know anything about the aviation business.
I give you that. I'm not arguing that with you. I'm saying I'll give you all of the technical expertise in the world. I'm speaking to you now as a passenger. That's something I do know. I know what it is to be a passenger, to be a consumer, to buy a seat on an aircraft. I know what it is to want to go from one city to the next.
So I know that too. So what I'm saying is I'm not only a pilot, I've been a passenger. So I've got a far better overall picture than you or any member of the public. And that's why I'm saying you cannot release this man's name. I don't want my name released in relation to this situation that happened.
Where you were going on and on about being United 93.
That is correct.
877-876-7445, 877-876-PHIL. We'll be back here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show.
We'll take a break.
Yes.
Phil Henry. World-famous Phil Henry Show.
Welcome back here on the world-famous Phil Henry... Whoops. Hold on. I won't do it again. Told myself that would never happen again. All right, now we're back. Just flipped on the audio feed there. Welcome back here on the world-famous... The audio feed for our video cast. World-famous Phil Henry Show, 877-876-PHIL is our number. And we welcome you back here to the broadcast this evening as we discuss... another one of these mid-air, you know, it seems, and I could be wrong, but it seems as if these mid-air episodes of a passenger doing this or that or something else have taken on new significance. Obviously, it's taken on new significance since 9/11. It also seems like maybe the incidents are going up, or maybe we're just noticing them more, because I was trying to think, before 9/11 happened, what did I hear on the news? On a semi-regular basis of mid-air incidents, per se. And as it turns out, when I was thinking about it, Art, and Art Griego is our guest here, I came up with a few.
Did you?
Yeah, I mean, I came up with one. I'll never forget this as long as I live. It was a horrible, horrible story, and I had just gotten home from work. It was about probably going on 40 years ago now, man. I just started in radio, and I'd just gotten home from work, and I was listening to the news, and a Delta flight that was going from Atlanta to L.A., somehow the cabin had depressurized, and a part of the cabin had been blown out, or there was a hole in the cabin or in the fuselage that it right out of a movie that sucked one of the passengers out into the night sky.
I think I know the episode you're talking about.
You know the one?
Yeah, it was over New Mexico, and they did immediately start a search for that man. It was a male passenger, and of course he was never found. I don't even know where you would begin to imagine to look when you're at that altitude, because I think they were up pretty high, about 25,000 feet.
And of course, you remember the was it Aloha Airlines?
That was in the 80s when a piece of not just a piece, the whole fuselage came apart, and that began a whole other series of investigations into how passengers react to stress. And what we have to, as pilots, be aware of.
Well, when you say how passengers react to stress, when a piece of the fuselage blows away like it did on Aloha Airlines, aren't you worried more about the equipment?
Well, the equipment is going to... You're going to have equipment failure, there's no question. But we've got great ground crews, we've got great engineers, we've got great designers, and we have a great aviation industry from the standpoint of manufacture. That's going to happen. But what you don't want to have happen is after something like that occurs, whether it's a piece of the fuselage or whether it's a passenger who has not strapped himself into his seat properly and has not put on his oxygen mask as he was told to, but instead was doing something else and now finds himself outside of the aircraft at 30,000 feet and he will not be telling anybody about it.
You're blaming the passenger, and I'm sure that there was perhaps there was some error there, but he can't help the fact that a piece of the fuselage got blown out.
No, he can't, and neither can the pilot, and neither can the airline. And
yes, the airline can. The airline can.
How can the airline help if a piece of the fuselage is lost in flight?
The airline is ultimately culpable in that it's their equipment. It was their piece of equipment that failed. something having to do with the metal fatigue they were talking about on that Aloha airline, or it might have something else to do with the manufacturer of the aircraft. Maybe it's got nothing to do with how old it is. Maybe it has to do with how it was put together. But this is ultimately the responsibility of the airline, isn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely ultimately the responsibility of the airline. It's also the responsibility of the passenger to make sure that he is doing what the flight crew told him to do and not be standing around getting something out of his bag. You talk about that passenger who got sucked out of the aircraft. And
all right, let me get to a phone call here, okay?
Hold on. Wait a minute. Because, again, there's no phone call you're going to take that's going to give you more information than I got. Okay, that guy that got sucked out of that aircraft over New Mexico, no doubt was doing something other than listening to the flight attendants when they said, be seated, please, put on your seat belts and safety belts and make sure that you're using the oxygen masks. Because by the time all of that started to happen and everybody was safely in their seat, belted in, and using oxygen, he was getting sucked out of the aircraft. Now, the airline has to explain that to his family. He's not there to say to his wife, I was standing around acting like a fool, and I wasn't paying attention, honey, and I got sucked out of the aircraft. No. Instead, the airline's going to be blamed.
All right, 877-876-PHIL, 877-876-7445. Art Griego is my guest here as we talk about the pilot that had the breakdown. And the fact that JetBlue is not releasing his name or his medical records, and Art feels that that is absolutely the correct decision because pilots, deserve to have their privacy, and that the real risk here is how the public reacts in some of these situations. 877-876-PHIL. Here is Jeff in Temple City. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I'm asking the pilot a question about what you had said earlier about being... I guess you yourself, you said you had a medical condition?
Well, I had an incident aboard my aircraft, yeah.
Yeah, did you say you had a breakdown too?
It was not a breakdown. It was bad judgment that did then eventually...
I thought I heard you say that...
You did mention it was emotional.
It was emotional, but it was born of something that a passenger did.
Okay, well, can I ask you? You said that you were on the radio to the passengers.
That's correct, sir. I had gotten on the talkback, the PA to the cabin, and I was pretending like I was the air traffic control for United 93.
Well, I mean, what were you saying?
I was just calling United 93, United 93, Cleveland, United 93.
So you were trying to scare people?
I was. It was a bad judgment on my part, yes, sir, because I had had a run-in with one of the passengers who had, asked me. They'd seen me on another flight. They asked me if I had a certain problem, a drinking problem or something. I don't know what it was. I forget now.
Had you been drinking on another flight?
No, I had not. They must have had me confused with someone, but it bothered me so much. And I'd been, as I said to you earlier, Phil, I'd had a long couple of days flying not only commercially but also flying for our startup company. And I really, I'm giving you a lot more information than I should.
Well, I mean, I think it's important. I just think it's important.
Hold on for just a minute, son. So I'm going to give you the story, but I'm just telling you, you're getting more information than I should be giving you.
Well, all right, we appreciate it, but so you got on the PA and started saying United 93, United 93, knowing that that was going to scare people.
Yeah, it was going to scare people, and it was going to get them to sit down. Basically, my message was this. Remember what happened on United 93? Well, what makes you think that this is so different?
Well, what was going on with the passengers?
Yeah, were they getting out of hand or something?
I'm sorry, what did you say?
Were they getting out of hand or something?
Okay, this is the caller?
Yes, sir.
That's my caller, yeah.
All right, well, can I speak with you, Mr. Henry, and just have this gentleman listen because he's...
I mean, I'm the caller that called up.
He's the guy that called up and wants the questions answered.
I know that, but he's... All right, so
what's wrong with me?
All right, I'll answer your question. So the...
Are you saying that you're better or something?
No, well, yes, I am saying I'm better than you.
You're saying you're better than me.
Yes, sir, I am, because of the way you sound.
We won't characterize this caller. Just tell me what led you to get on the PA and start saying United 93 and scaring those passengers.
I was going to tell you. I had had a long couple of days, as I said.
Right.
And I'd had this run-in with the first-class passenger who said, oh, don't I know you from another flight? Weren't you that guy on Northwest who'd been drinking? Ha, ha, ha. I didn't think it was funny. And I realized that I could possibly have a group of passengers that were going to get out of control. And I was tired, and I was fed up. And so I began saying United 93.
Now, all right, so what happened?
What happened was I was given a medical leave. And at which time I told them that I don't want my medical records to be revealed, and they weren't. And
what airline were you flying for?
I'm not going to tell you that.
All right, so in other words, your medical records were sealed, and the airline that you flew for is sealed, and and what caused this breakdown is sealed. You're telling me it's because you were simply tired.
Yeah, I'm sorry, sir, but I don't buy that because, I mean, there's a lot of pilots who are tired. But they don't have an emotional breakdown.
Wait a minute. Who said I had an emotional breakdown? You're telling me I had an emotion. I didn't have an emotional breakdown. I had an error in judgment.
An error in judgment where you decided that you would freak out the passengers by saying United 93.
I was angry at the way passengers think that they're entitled to all kinds of information. That's why I'm on your show tonight, to say that no, they're not. And I'm not about to start telling somebody every hemorrhoid that I've had.
I'm not asked about a hemorrhoid.
I'm still talking to this guy, huh?
All right, Jeff, thanks very much for your call.
Okay, but I'm just saying.
877-876-PHIL here with Art Griego. Okay, Art, so you win the argument. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and just beat it into the ground. If you don't want to release your medical records, you don't have to release your medical records. I guess if the airline you flew for, whoever they are, was successful in keeping them private. But I dare say, and if you don't understand this, I don't know what else to tell you. If I'm flying in an aircraft and I know that there's a pilot who at one time had gotten on the PA or whatever it is, telling everybody this is United 93, United 93, and acting very weird like that, I wouldn't want to fly in that airline.
Of course you wouldn't, and I wouldn't blame you. But I never did that again. And why are you going? So in other words, what I'm saying is, because I never did that again, there was no reason not to fly that airline. However, if they made public the report on it, people would have prejudged me and said, I don't want to fly that airline, even though I wasn't going to do it again.
How do they know you're not going to do it again?
Because I said, if you don't want to believe me, all right. But I said, I'm not going to do it again. I gave my word.
Well, in a perfect world, giving our word would be a nice thing.
Well, yeah. In a perfect world, in a moral and in a sane world, when a man gives his word, we ought to accept it. The fact they didn't accept it means that I gave my word, and the company wouldn't accept it, and the company was acting in an insane way.
All right, 877-876-PHIL with Art Griego here, who had a similar situation, maybe not similar, but got on the talkback on the PA on an aircraft and started saying United 93, United 93 to the passengers and freaking them out, I have to imagine. JetBlue today had a pilot flip out. He had a, quote, bizarre midair breakdown. He had to be restrained by passengers before he was taken off the aircraft. Don't you think these pilots should have their medical conditions, their medical histories publicized so passengers, the public itself can make up their minds? 877-876-7445. Phil Hendry Show.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show. Famous Phil Hendry Show.
877-876-PHIL. Because of what we were saying, let me get my pilot back on the line here. I got on the line here is Art Griego. Is that Jonathan?
Yes.
Okay, Jonathan, you had it. Art, are you there?
Right here. I was going to. Jim Schultz wanted to say something to you.
Okay, let me talk to Jim in a second. Jonathan, what was your question?
He said that the pilot said that it happens to the best of us. those types of mishaps, and I was wondering how often they actually happen in real life.
Hold on, Jim. How long does it happen? What did you say, sir? How often does it happen?
How often those type of pilot mishaps actually happen?
Well, I can't really tell you. I can tell you that in my career, it happened a couple of times to me, and I've seen it happen a couple of times. It probably is not all that common. For a pilot, it is. You know, it's part of the business of controlling the stress of the job. And so I'd say that it happens, but it doesn't happen so often that it concerns me. Now, if we let out to the public the actual number of incidents that we have, the public is going to do what the public does, which is basically panic. And
I think that's a bad way of looking at it. The public has a right to make up their minds.
You're right. The public does have a right to make up their mind. But unfortunately, I'm looking at this as a professional. I fly an aircraft, and you're asking me to turn over control of that aircraft to someone who
gets
nervous.
Well, I'm not asking you control. All I was asking was how often they actually happen.
No, I'm talking to Phil right now. I'm not talking to you. Did you get your... It happens often enough. It happens often enough. But for you, Phil...
Well, the public, whether they're professional or not, are going to want to know about the health of the pilot.
That's fine. They can ask all the questions they want, but I'm not going to tell them what's happened to me in my life so they can turn around and start mocking me or making fun of me and making me angrier. Is that what you're talking about, sir?
Yeah, that was it. Thank you.
All right, you're welcome. So what I'm saying basically is that you don't have in the aircraft anybody other than the pilot or the co-pilot. And the pilot or the co-pilot, these are people that are in control of the aircraft. And if someone's making fun of me, you know, I have to...
What do you mean making fun of you?
They're saying, oh, weren't you that guy that was drinking? Let me get Jim up here. Jim Schultz. Hey, Jim. How's that? This is a guy who's been flying. I've been flying Jim back and forth to Las Vegas. How do you enjoy the flight, Jim?
That's good. Let me tell you.
Hold on for a minute. I want this gentleman to talk to you, Phil, because he flies with me from Vegas to L.A. constantly. You like the flight?
I go, that's the best flight ever. Who is this?
Hi, Jim. It's Phil Hendry.
Hey, Phil. This guy here has been so wonderful in flying me.
And flying here. Here's the phone again.
Fly me and fly my crew and my wife, everybody. God bless him. That's what he put up with.
And, anyway, give me a phone.
I want to say to you and everybody listening to him that you fly with this man here. He's the best guy there is.
All right.
Best one there is.
Gotta get a drink. And they enjoy themselves. Philly's having a drink. I'm flying. I'm safe. What else do you want me to tell you?
Well, you don't need to tell me anything else. You're flying a completely different kind of an aircraft now. This is a small jet. It's a small jet, a charter, right?
Yeah. They hire me, and I've been flying Jim Schultz and his crew. These are guys from his company to Las Vegas. I've been flying them back and forth for years.
Is that right? Show my wife talk, okay?
Hold on. No.
Give us some other guy.
Hold on.
Give us some other guy. That's right.
Are you... You're flying the airplane, or the aircraft.
I'm flying it, yeah. I'm navigating a jet right now. No, everything's fine, but he got a hold of the air phone here. We got a receiver.
I'm going to give it here to my wife, okay?
No. You just sit down, because I got to talk to Mr. Henry.
Go, baby.
I have to talk to Mr. Henry.
See, to me, what I'm hearing right now is the exact thing that you told me you don't want to have to deal with.
On a commercial aircraft with hundreds of people, no, I don't.
I'm going to give a phone talk to my wife.
Hold on. Sit down, will you? On a commercial aircraft, no, I don't. But I've only got six passengers here.
Well, that guy sounds like he's jumping on and off the phone.
There's an extension here. Put the extension down, Jim, because Phil thinks that I'm in danger or something.
He's got to do it. Gotta do it.
Sit down, Jim, will you?
That guy sounds, and you are sounding like you're angry now.
I'm not angry. He's just, he's drunk. And he had a, did you have anything to eat?
Oh, what?
Did you have anything to eat tonight?
Not from home.
The what?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think you had anything to eat. Did you have anything to eat? Have some of these pretzels.
Oh, hey.
He doesn't sound good at all, man. Is he having a good time?
What do you care if he's having a good time?
What I'm saying, I don't care, but I'm trying to say, is he drunk as in happy drunk, or is he about to get sick?
I don't know. Jim, are you going to get sick?
What?
Are you going to get sick?
I'm going to...
Give me the phone, man. Don't drool on it. God.
See, you know what, man? You came on here trying to prove that you're in control of your aircraft. You're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. And for you to say that I'm not, it's what... Now, how about that? How about that? We're going to crash. You bastard.
Don't you pull me!
Okay, I don't know. Phil Henry Show.
Phil Henry. Shores of El Pacifico. Phil Henry.
877-876-PHIL, the world-famous Phil Henry Show here from the El Pacifico every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast, 4 a.m. on the East Coast. A news, talk, and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about. And the other talk shows, man, they wish they could go some of the places we go to. Although I'm sure they're just as happy doing what they're doing. And you know,
maybe you wish they could go where they're going.
Well, yeah, that's there are those nights. Anyway, 877-876-PHIL is our number here. We do have Vernon Dozier on the line, who is an educator from Belmar Academy in Glendale, California. We're going to talk about a couple of things. First off, this situation in Florida vis-a-vis the shooting of this young man, Trayvon Martin, by this other young man, George Zimmerman. You know, Zimmerman, over the last few days, friends of Zimmerman's have come forward to say he's not a racist. And, you know, there's also the people who are involved in what is now a million hoodies for Trayvon Martin, basically saying that the hoodie should not be, as Geraldo Rivera said, some kind of an impetus or a some sort of evil symbol of gangwear that young people should avoid because it's only going to get you in trouble. I mean, Geraldo Rivera really ran afoul of a lot of public opinion when he made that statement. And you're a high school teacher, Vernon. What do you think about what Rivera said?
I agree with people. Geraldo Rivera is, I think he's a good reporter at times, but I think there are other times when he, this is the same guy, Phil, that, you know, was doing all of that silly stuff with the vault of Al Capone, and this is also a man, let's be very mindful of the fact that this is also a man that was filling America's head full of all this Satanism and this devil worship stuff back in the 80s, which led to, in my opinion, that led directly to what happened to the West Memphis Three, those three young people that were arrested and charged and tried and convicted of a murder they didn't commit because of the hysteria, especially in some of these smaller towns that are a little more rural, and perhaps they don't have the, I don't know what you want to call it, maybe there's not the sophistication or what have you, but they bought into this kind of nonsense. And Geraldo Rivera, let's remember, who was at the was one of the bright lights of that Satanism panic. It was Geraldo Rivera. So when he says something about hoodies, and he even admitted that his own son,
yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, his own son told him on Twitter, you know, that...
Yeah, he said that that his son had messaged him and said that he was ashamed of what he was saying, And I guess to Rivera's credit, he said, you know, my son said this, and it hurts me, but I have to stick with my opinion.
Well, you don't have to stick with your opinion. You know, you can change your mind. You can change your opinion. I don't know what he's saying, but I think he's I don't think he's fulfilling his role very well as a so-called respected journalist. Again, I don't have anything against Geraldo Rivera, but you have to remember where this guy's been. And he's been down some. He's stuck his nose into some real garbage cans. The Satanism thing, that ridiculous Al Capone stuff. The ridiculous TV show he had with the neo-Nazis broke his nose or whatever that was.
That was a daytime show. He had a bunch of Nazis on there. Somebody swung a chair.
Yeah, someone swung a chair. Somebody said, "Well, that's probably the best his nose ever looked." I don't wish any ill on any man.
That was definitely a violent situation that did not have to happen. I think that when you're doing a show like that, and Geraldo Rivera, and I've watched this guy over the years, he's a pretty good. He's a showman.
Sure, he's a showman, but I thought he was also a newsman. Yeah.
Well, I mean, increasingly, more and more, you know, you're right. You're absolutely right. But I don't think that he's so stupid as to ignore where the industry's headed. So you can call yourself a newsman. At the end of the day, you don't have a job. You're not eating. You're not getting a paycheck. Nobody wants you unless you adapt.
You call that adapting. That's fine. But
you're saying it's not news coverage.
No, it's not news coverage. It's what you called it. It's a three-ring circus. But the guy, Phil, you wanted me to come on it to comment. The guy who, in my opinion, in the situation in Sanford, Florida, with the shooting of this young man from Miami by this guy Zimmerman, the guy who is going to be out of a job and should be out of a job very, very soon is this DA who did not press charges. Now, the news story that I've got here, and we discussed this today in our class, social science class, the detective, man by the name of Chris Sereno, I don't know if he works for the city of Sanford or if he was a county cop. No, it says he's a Sanford Police Department investigator. He wanted to charge this guy. He wanted to put this guy Zimmerman behind bars, charged with manslaughter. In an affidavit taken the night, now this was taken on the night of the shooting, February the 26th, on the night that Trayvon Martin was killed. Sereno stated he was unconvinced by Zimmerman's version of events.
Unconvinced.
Unconvinced. He was unconvinced by Zimmerman's version of events. Sounds to me like he was the only guy in that whole situation that had his head screwed on straight. Because if you look at the news stories and everything that everybody's been talking about, you'd swear that every single person that talked to this guy Zimmerman after this happened, they all bought his version. Like, oh, okay, if that's what you say, then I guess that's what happened. Not one person questioned, well, maybe it went a different way, you know. Not one person. And here's a guy, this guy Sereno, and he's got an affidavit now, so he ain't lying.
What does it say?
It says it's an affidavit taken the night of February 26th.
Okay, so what is he saying this?
He states that he was unconvinced by Zimmerman's version of events in which he claimed self-defense. This is being reported by ABC.
Okay.
And now the state attorney, Norman Wolfinger, has refused to comment. He's the guy, that's his office, that said there wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest. Now, I'm here on your radio show tonight. I'm going to tell you something right now, and you better believe this. That guy Wolfinger, and I hope that your show, do you go down to Florida? Do you get it?
Yeah, we're on in Florida.
All right, let me say this real clear to Florida. This guy Wolfinger is out of a job. If this guy doesn't get fired sooner or later, and maybe sooner rather than later, but I don't know, if he ain't fired, then they got a bigger problem than we already know they got a DA problem in Florida because of the way they let that Casey Anthony walk. Everybody talks about how the jury was stupid. I don't think the jury was stupid so much as the prosecuting attorneys in that case blew it. But I'm telling you, this guy Wolfinger, this guy is going to be fired if there's a God in heaven. And
that now you're given an opinion. If there's a God in heaven, you want him fired, right?
Yeah, I want him fired. Of course I want him fired. Who doesn't want him fired? Don't you want him fired?
I haven't even thought about the state attorney. What I've been thinking about were the cops on scene. You know, you're talking about the state attorney doesn't think there's enough evidence. What did the cops say? This one cop said that he wanted to press charges. What about the other cops?
I don't know about the other. The other cop said there wasn't enough evidence. That guy, what's his face?
Chief of police?
Yeah, that Bill Lee. He said there wasn't enough evidence.
Well, here's the thing. The DA is going to take a look at everything. The state's attorney is going to take a look at everything that the cops bring him, and he's going to assess whether they can bring charges or not.
That's right.
So apparently they didn't bring him much.
They didn't bring him up. Here's one guy here, Serino, who said, I think it should have been a manslaughter rap.
Well, he must have been outvoted. I mean, he's the first guy and maybe the only guy that I've heard of from the Sanford Police Department that said something should have been done.
So?
So, obviously, there were a lot of other cops who didn't think the same way.
All right, well, here's what they ought to do. They ought to fire that attorney, and I think they ought to fire that dumbass chief they got. I'll tell you right now, if you're talking about, in my opinion, they should clean house at that cop department, except for this guy Serino. Make this guy the chief of police. That's the brightest. That guy's the smartest guy on that force that night. That's the only guy that had any brains going that night.
All right, Vernon Dozier with us. Hang on, Vernon. We'll be right back. 877-876-PHIL as we talk with him about the, that situation in Sanford on the 26th of February, on that night when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed by George Zimmerman. Does anybody know what happened? No. What do we got? 911 tapes. We got this guy Zimmerman's point of view. We've got a few witnesses. We see people who saw grass stains on the guy's shirt, this, that. A state's attorney that says there's no evidence. Cops that say there's no evidence. Now, all of a sudden, there's one lone police inspector who says, I would have charged him with manslaughter. 877-876-7445, the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show. Bill Hendry Show.
877-876-PHIL here on whatever night this is, Tuesday night. And welcome back to the program. Vernon Dozier is joining us. Vernon is he's one of our longtime contributors. He's an educator. He's a high school teacher. And he's a smart guy. We've had our run-ins on the air before, Vernon. But I would say overall, it's been entertaining anyway.
Well, you got to be honest though. With the run-ins we've had, I could say that I'm a man that knows my own mind.
Well, you got more to deal with at that school you teach at than on this radio show. But we're talking about Trayvon Martin. There's a couple of things that we wanted to talk about tonight, not just Trayvon Martin. But also the Supreme Court health law, it's the health care law that the Supreme Court is going to be weighing tomorrow. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, my feeling on the health care is very simply this. The Supreme Court is going to look and see if the people of this country can be required to carry health insurance. And I don't know what the answer to that is, to be honest with you. It could very well be that we are. It could very well be that we're not. But then you have the question of, is it a good idea? Now, here's where you can't argue with it. I think it is a good idea.
You think it is a good idea?
I think universal health care. Oh, anybody with a brain, and I mean anyone with a brain, knows that universal health care is a good idea because it... first of all, it alleviates the burden on the so-called health care system the United States has to the tune of trillions of dollars every year of trying to insure or trying to provide health care to people. And most people who don't have it, obviously, the rest of us are picking up the tab for that anyway. So I don't see how it's not a good idea. But can the Supreme Court rule that we've got to have health coverage? I don't know. The Supreme Court already recognizes that if you want to drive a car, you have to have a license. But here's the thing. Not everybody has to drive a car. It is constitutional to require that if you drive a car, you have to have automobile insurance. But not everybody has to drive a car. People can walk. People can take a bus. If you're walking, of course, you don't need to have automobile insurance. If you're taking a bus, the price of your bus fare is obviously going to be inflated so that the bus has insurance. Because the bus has got to be insured, and they're not going to pick up the cost themselves or pass it along to you. So you are insuring yourself if you're in any kind of transportation other than walking. I have to tell you, I don't know how many people walk to work, Phil, or how many people walk to whatever errands or whatever places of business they have to be at during any given day. But I think it's a hell of a thing to take a look at the fact that there's people walking, and they're the only ones that are not paying for transportation insurance. Everybody else pays. You see what I'm saying?
No, not quite. So in other words,
but what I'm saying to you is this. They say that when I say to people, well, you have to have car insurance, they say, yeah, but you don't have to own a car. Okay, well, if you take a bus, the price of your fare, the price of your fare includes how much it costs the bus company to insure the bus. If you take a cab, the price of your fare includes how much it costs to insure the cab. If you take a coach, any kind of transportation, you're paying for the insurance other than walking. And if it wasn't for that, we'd have an airtight argument against anybody that says there's no mandatory insurance elsewhere in American life other than Obamacare.
Well, all right. Well, it sounds to me like, so in other words, what are you saying? I mean,
You're listening to me, right?
Yeah, I'm listening to you.
I'm saying to you that everybody pays insurance for automobiles.
Well, what you're saying is everybody pays transportation insurance.
Exactly.
All right. So it is required.
Yes, transportation insurance is required because everyone has to pay for it. So it's a misnomer to say that you are not required to buy automobile insurance, because if you get into any vehicle, anything with four wheels, you're paying for insurance. Now, people say, well, you don't have to, you can walk. And that is something that it makes me angry. I'll tell you why, because that's the dumbest thing. In other words, you have to be stupid to say to me, a high school teacher, well, you don't have to have insurance on cars, you can walk. Because that's just, I don't even want to discuss it. That's so stupid.
Well, wait a minute. What we're talking about here, if you could just hold on for a minute. What we're talking about here is we're talking about having to have health insurance.
Yeah, we're talking about Obamacare being mandatory.
Okay, and then when people say, and you're in favor of that.
Absolutely in favor of it.
Okay, and when people say to you, well, that's the only place in American life where you have to have insurance because nowhere else do you have to have it. You bring up automobile insurance.
I bring up automobile insurance. And when they say to me, well, you don't have to drive a car, I say, yes, but every form of transportation you take, you are paying for insurance, whether it's the automobile, whether it's a bus, whether it's a car, whether it is a limousine, whether it is some kind of coach service, whether if it's a shuttle from the airport, you're the insurance for those vehicles is factored into what you're paying. And then they'll say this to me. They'll say, well, then you don't have to take that. You can walk. You still have that option. And that's when I say to them, you have to be, I will tell you, I got into this discussion with a young lady's mom. She's a great student of mine. Her name is Sarah Rigby. Her mother and I got into this discussion at a parent-teacher conference about 3 weeks ago. And I had to say to her, I said, you know, you've got a wonderful daughter. She's a very, very smart girl. You are so stupid. And she, you know, went to the board on me, and I had to deal with all kinds of stuff. And
well, what was she saying?
She said that to me. She said, well, then you don't have to take a car. You can walk. And I said, what human being in America walks as their primary means of getting around? She says, well, that's just their problem, you know, talking like a real, you know. I mean, she was just talking like an imbecile. And I said to her, I said, for a woman that gave birth to such a brilliant young lady, boy, you are dumb. And she gave me the big wide-eyed look like, how dare you? And the next day I got a call from Bill Hedgecock, who's our headmaster.
All right, well, I mean, that's your problem with a parent. You shouldn't have said that she was dumb.
But she was stupid. And that's the kind of thing I got to deal with all the time. I've always got to deal with people who say the same thing. Well, then you can walk. Man,
But it's true. I mean, let me just play devil's advocate here. It is true. Then all you have to do is you know, not ride in a car, not ride in a cab, not ride in a bus.
Yeah, okay. And who does that, Phil? Tell me.
I don't know, but it is an option.
No, it is not an option. No, it is not an option. Okay?
Well, yes, it is. You can walk to work.
I can walk to... Okay. Let's say that I can walk to work. I work at Belmar Academy. What you're telling me is I need to buy a home that's around, $1 million for the home, because the only homes around Belmar Academy are $1 million. Now, let's say I walk. Let's say I live... What do you figure? You can walk 15... You can walk a mile in 15 minutes. So let's say I don't mind walking to work every day. It would take me an hour to go 4 miles, to walk 4 miles to work, if you can walk a mile in 15 minutes. So let's say I live 4 miles away from Belmar Academy. 4 miles away from Belmar Academy is either coyote country, where there's no houses at all, or it's a freeway. And off of the freeway are some pretty dilapidated, run-down, real toilets. I wouldn't live in them unless I wanted to get some disease. Okay? Crime-ridden, lice-ridden, filthy. So that's what you're telling me. I got to live in some toilet bowl in order to fulfill some woman's dream about me walking to work.
No, I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that just by your own words alone, you said you could live, conceivably, you could live 4 miles from work, and you could walk every day to and from work. It would take you 1 hour's commute time. You know,
commute time. That's what we're calling it now, walking.
Well, yeah, but I mean, suppose you live closer.
I can't live closer because the homes are $1 million apiece. That's what I'm trying to say to you.
All right. Vernon Dozier with us here as we talk about health insurance. Should you be required to buy health insurance? You're required to buy insurance for automobiles, buses, trains, whatever you ride in, whatever you take to go places. 877-876-7445. The Phil Henry Show.
Bill Henry Show.
877-876-PHIL here. Welcome back to the world-famous Phil Henry Show. We have Vernon Dozier on the line as we talk with him about the, you know, as we talk with him about this health care law that is going before the Supreme Court tomorrow. Now, the law, this is the Obamacare law that tomorrow will be heard, I guess, by the Supreme Court, which means that they have attorneys representing opponents and the attorneys representing the proponents. And those would be, of course, attorneys arguing on behalf of the United States government. The fate of the health care overhaul will be on the line Wednesday when the Supreme Court considers whether the entire law must fall without its centerpiece insurance mandate. That is the requirement for insurance. Completing 3 days of historic arguments, the nine justices will hear arguments on whether the rest of the law, Obama's signature domestic accomplishment, can survive should the court decide Congress exceeded its powers by requiring all Americans buy insurance by 2014. The Obama administration faced skeptical questioning on Tuesday from the court's five-member conservative majority on the insurance requirement, but it was unclear whether it would strike it down or let it stand. You know, I think this whole thing about whether there's a conservative judges or liberal judges, I think that stuff's overrated. What do you think, Vernon?
I don't know. I've seen conservative, so-called conservative judges go liberal. I've seen liberal judges go conservative. I mean, probably the most, I think the most glaring example of that, if you're a student of history, is when Earl Warren became the Supreme Court Justice. He was a conservative Republican governor. He was the governor of the state of California, as a matter of fact, when he was named to Supreme Court. And yet it was Earl Warren's court that ruled in favor of Brown versus the Board of Education, meaning that to integrate public schools. It was Earl Warren's court that ruled on in favor of a variety of Federalist issues during his time. So, and he was a conservative. He was nominated and put in a place there by President Eisenhower. So you see, what the job is of these guys is not to be a conservative, it's not to be a liberal, it's to be a judge. It's to interpret the Constitution of the United States. I try to tell my students that. I try to drill it into their heads because I know sooner or later they're going home to their parents, and this is something you and I have disagreed on.
Well, I mean, your whole thinking is that every time the students leave your classroom to go home to their parents, they're going home to basically get dumb again.
That's a great way of describing it, yeah.
And you don't mind coming on a radio show and saying that?
Well, I mean, I've learned over the years, Phil, knowing you, that there's such a thing as selective listening. I don't know how many of those parents are listening to me, and I don't care. I mean, fact is, am I lying?
Are you lying about what?
When I say that my students leave my classroom and they go home to parents where a good 80% of them are going home to a dumb factory, if you want to put it in a humorous way.
Going home to a dumb factory, that means...
Well, what do you think it means?
I don't know, Vernon. You're the guy that's...
It means that they're going home to people that are going to dumb them up again.
So they're leaving your brilliant classroom... And
well, there's no point in getting sarcastic, Phil. I'm trying to make a point about education today.
I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but what I am trying to say to you is, you know, parents have got... Let me just put it to you like this, okay?
And remember, Phil, I've never been a parent.
Okay, so let's you and I, for a moment, just refresh our memories. You got work. You got a marriage. You've got children. And
well, then maybe you shouldn't have had those kids. You're going to start to tell me how tough it is being a parent? Is that what you're going to tell me? Because that don't play with me. That don't play with me at all. Anybody wants to sing the blues with me about being a parent, you just keep right on walking. Just head right on down the road, because I don't want to hear it.
Well, all right, man. I mean, you know, it's your entire life has been spent as a professional. Your entire life is as a teacher. You've spent all of your time as an educator, all of your time in education, and all of your time in your profession dealing with kids. This is your focus. This is what you do. And I think you think at times that that's what a parent does. Parents don't do that. They're not 24/7 kid-minded, you know.
Well, I think a lot of them better start. Yep.
Well, maybe they ought to, but it's the perfect world we do. I will tell you, with what this world forces upon people, there's a lot of parents doing a pretty good job. Margaret Gray is joining us here from Santa Monica. She is not only a parent, but she's also somebody who has dealt with the issues from the standpoint of a journalist. Margaret, how are you doing?
Well, Phil, I thought I would call in because it sounds like it shows, once again, dying a horrible death.
Thank you very much for that.
I don't know what she thinks about that either. You know?
Well, I'm listening to the two of you just blah, 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 and it's just this monotonous conversation. I thought I would jump in and lend a woman's voice to this.
Lending a woman's voice, huh?
And who am I speaking with?
That's Vernon.
That's Vernon Dozier.
Oh, all right. Well, I'm familiar with you, Mr. Dozier.
If you said Phil's show was dying a horrible death, then you must have known I was on the air.
Well, I knew I was listening to two voices. One was Phil, and the other was someone who sounded very angry and didn't sound very considered.
I guess that's me, huh?
Yes, that would be you. Yeah, that's right. Now, can I finish what I'm going to say?
Go ahead.
Go on.
What I was going to say is this. I was out there listening. Frank and I were coming back, okay, from Sarah Melton's house where she had a reading. Bill Tetlock's book is coming out, and he did a reading. And I can tell you it's going to be phenomenal. And
I don't even know which.
Would you hold on, please?
Hold on. I'll tell you. It's a book. Is he a political scientist?
No, he's he's a screenwriter.
There you go, Phil. He's a screen. He's a political scientist, no.
I'd like to finish what I'm saying without him butting in.
Okay, I'm sorry. I don't know who this guy is.
Who this guy is? He's one of the hottest screenwriters in Hollywood. He's just written a book.
We're talking about education, ma'am. We're talking about young people. We're talking about saving the lives of young people. And the brains that are being literally drained out of ears... Because we've got parents out there that aren't bright enough to help these kids, and there's a Supreme Court ruling tomorrow on the health care law because the kids have got the brains leaking from the ears, and they're you know, I'm like the, you know.
What is he talking about?
Hold on.
I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm like that little Dutch boy who's got his finger in the dike, okay? And you gonna make a joke?
No, but you wanted to make a joke, I could tell.
All right, let's grow up, okay?
I didn't say anything.
Well, then why did you stop down on the word dyke?
Because I figured you'd want to make a joke.
You figured wrong, sir. You know something, Phil? I don't need this.
All right, well, Margaret, you called in.
I want to say what I want to say.
You're going to say what you want to say after I get done. I'm like the little Dutch boy with his finger in a dyke, and only my finger is in the ears of kids because I don't want the brains to leak.
You don't want the brains to leak. Boy, you are in trouble.
That you might have put that a little bit better.
I know what I'm trying to say.
What you're trying to say is kids are going home to dumb parents and they're getting dumbed up again, and then all of your great work as a teacher is undone. I understand, and one of the things you are not considering, and maybe you should have more faith in the kids themselves, that they themselves are people and that they have the ability to retain information, the ability to think in a discriminating way, that they don't have to believe every stupid thing that's said to them by everybody. You mentioned this kid, what's her name?
That's that little girl, that Sarah Rigby girl.
Yeah, you say she's really smart.
Yeah, and she's got an imbecile for a mother.
Oh, my God, and you don't mind saying that on the live radio station, do you?
Wow, on the live radio.
Okay, come on, Vernon.
Well, you see, this man can't open his mouth without mocking people, and I was told you're very intelligent.
I guess I'm not intelligent enough, ma'am. I was waiting for you to finish that sentence on the live. I don't know what you were going to say.
I was saying on the live radio station.
Well, Mr. Henry's got more than one radio station.
Will you people quit getting bogged down in all this minutia? So now I forgot what the point was.
Well, this lady was making the point.
I was saying that you're mocking the girl's mother on a radio station, on the live radio station. Is that what you do? Do you expect parents to cooperate with you when you do that?
I expect parents. I'll tell you, Ms., I don't know what your name, Brown? Is it Brown?
No, it's Gray.
Well, it's a color. That was a joke, ma'am.
Okay, move on, will you, Vernon?
Move what?
Move on, he said. I get it. It's a joke.
I forget.
All right. You know something? I don't think we have a conversation going on anymore. We just have a lot of hurt feelings.
Well, I want to say one more thing, Phil. I said to you earlier in the program that Frank's 73rd birthday is coming up, and I wanted to sing the song, the Sammy Davis Jr. song, in honor of Frank, my husband. It's from the movie Tinker Tailor... Tinker Tailor Tiny Sailor, something like that.
Tinker Tailor, here we go again, Phil. You know, this is going to be a comedy bit on one of the comedy records that you do, you know. I'll be trying to say it. See, it's called Tinker Tailor Tiny.
No, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Yes, that's the movie.
Yeah.
I want to sing the song, he's not the first, he's not the worst. He's the second best secret agent in the whole damn world. He's not the... Then it goes on to something else. But, Frank, that's for you.
Thank you. That was pathetic.
I beg your pardon?
Nothing.
No, I heard you say something. What did you say?
He said nothing. He said nothing.
No, he said it. What did he say, Frank?
He said it was pathetic. And I agree.
You agree? You...
Okay, 877-876-PHIL. What a bunch of psychos. Is Vernon still there? Is Vernon there? Okay, we'll get him back on. 877-876-7445, the world-famous Phil Henry Show. What the hell did we just talk about there? We went from talking about health care to her singing that song from Tinker Tailor Tiny Taylor, whatever the movie was. The world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Henry Show.
It's Tinker Tailor.
Well, I know who he is.
This is the world-famous Phil Henry Show.
Welcome back here on the Phil Henry Show, and... Vernon, you got us up on the I believe you said you have us up on your video cast.
Yeah, I'm looking at the video. It's a very good picture you got there, Phil, and very beautiful ocean there behind you. That's your El Pacifico, huh?
We have our studio here. We also have Margaret Gray. Margaret, a happy birthday to Frank.
Happy birthday to Frank. To Frank's what? It's Frank's birthday.
A happy birthday to Frank's. A happy birthday to Frank.
A happy birthday to Frank's. Anything on him that hasn't fallen off, I guess.
Mr. Dozier, is it?
That's correct.
I guess I'm just not really in the mood for any of your humor because it's crude.
What was crude about that?
Anything that hasn't fallen off of him.
Yes, again, what is crude about that?
Well, I think what you're saying essentially is this. I'm the man's wife. He's 73. The thing that you think might have fallen off of him would have a lot to do with me, wouldn't it?
Ma'am.
Would it not have a lot to do with me?
All right, Margaret, why take this personal? You know.
Hold on for a minute, Phil, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
And why would it be falling off? Because what, it rotted off?
Why are you going there with this? There's no need.
Excuse me, Phil. Because it rotted off?
Yes, ma'am, that's what I was saying.
You know something? If it wasn't for the fact that I was going to sing this second greatest whatever the hell, Mr. Dozier, I'd love to have a conversation with you. I'd love to have the conversation with you that other woman had, that Rigby woman.
Yeah?
You know what I'd do? I'd loosen a few of your teeth.
That's very funny.
Yeah, you think it's funny? Frank, tell him.
It's not funny, man. Oh, I don't care what P-word you married.
And P-word, baby, oh.
All right, buddy,
Are you going to sing this song?
What?
Are you singing the song?
Yeah, I'll sing the song, but this guy. Oh. Did you do it, Phil?
Yeah, I did. I apologize. We had the audio turned off again.
Boy, you have got to be the deck. I want to say that you are the stupidest guy I've ever met. You and that DA in Florida.
I apologize.
You apply every time you've got that audio turned off on your video feed. It's a damn good thing I'm on the air with you. I'd be sitting there listening to nothing.
You got to be kidding. You had the thing turned off.
I did.
Oh, man. Phil, I'm trying desperately to see you as a thinking and reasonable man. How many times are you going to have that video feed turned off?
I apologize.
No, not good enough, no.
It is not good enough. It is not good enough.
It is not good enough. God, you sound like you sound like an idiot savant or something.
You know, lady, I have never said these words before in my life. I almost feel like I'm so angry I would molest you.
Oh, my God.
What did you say to my wife? You heard what I said. That's how pissed off she makes me.
All right, I'm going to hang the phone up on you in 5 seconds here. I want to hear this song, No More Conversation.
All right.
I said no more conversation. Sing your song, Margaret. Sing it. Sing it.
All right, I'm going to sing it. God, what a pain in the ass.
He's not the first.
He's not the worst.
But he's the second best.
Can we bring that? I have to bring that down, Phil.
All right, well, I'm not the one that's playing the piano on this thing.
It's not a piano. It's a recording.
I've got to turn. Would you back it up, please? Back it up. Would you back that?
Oh, did you hear what she... Oh, man, did you hear that? Boy, I'll tell you, I'm going to have the FCC on me.
Yeah, I heard it. You said back that black what?
I didn't say black.
Yes, you did.
What a racist.
Calling me a racist. I voted for Obama. I would have voted for Obama 6 times.
Well, then why did I hear back that black something?
I meant Sammy Davis Jr. I didn't say black. I said back that black Sammy Davis.
Yeah, back that back the black Sammy Davis Jr. up, Phil, not the white one.
I'm ashamed of you. I really am. All right, here, I'm going to back it up. Go ahead, sing it.
Oh, quit making a big deal out of nothing, will you?
He's not the first.
He's not the worst.
Okay, that's it. I can't take it anymore.
What did you do?
I'm hanging up. That's what I'm doing. What did I do?
He's not the first.
All right, so thank you very much, Margaret Gray and Vernon Dozier, for your jive-ass opinions tonight, man. Wow.
I'll tell you about that one fat comment she made about Sammy Davis Jr.
Well, what was her problem? Boy, she's one of those people, when she gets angry, she's one of those white folks. I guess the same could be said for black people. Once they get angry, man, it really comes pouring out of them then, doesn't it?
What'd she do?
Oh, she goes, would you back that black? And then she, you know, held up on it.
Yeah, that you don't say that about Sammy Davis.
Yeah, I mean, I... God, unreal. And that's that. Margaret, Ms. Gray is one of the most liberal of people in terms of her, I guess, her social contacts, her professional contacts, the world that she lives in. I mean, all she ever talks about is, you know, Obama this and Obama that. And she gets just angry enough, and here it comes, back that black.
Wow.
All right, it's the world-famous Phil Henry Show. We were going to hold this off for our news and information hour, but why not just announce it right now? Because it was actually pretty good news, and I know you guys like this. I would say it's a local story, but I think it's a national story in the sense that the Yankees, the Dodgers, the certain teams that represent, I think, baseball, don't you? You know, I can tell you this, as a longtime Los Angeles Dodger fan, it's just a longtime baseball fan, I don't want to see anybody mess with the New York Yankees. Because the New York Yankees are the New York Yankees. In other words, I may not root for them in the World Series, and I may love to hate them like we all do. When I see those pinstripes, and I see those home runs, and I see those World Championships, and I see all that the Yankees have accomplished, I love to hate them. But I don't want to see those pinstripes go away. I don't want to see Yankee Stadium go away. I don't want to see all those monuments go away. I don't want to see that stadium. You know, they are a sacrosanct institution in America. Well, in a lot of ways, maybe the Dodgers are the same for some. I'm not saying they're anywhere near as big as the Yankees. For me, they're significant. And a piece of news happened today that I thought was pretty good. I'm just speaking for myself, and that is that a group of investors led by Magic Johnson.
I think this is great news.
Magic Johnson. What do you think, Robert?
Yeah, I think it's good. I'm going to wait and see, man. Who's going to be coming out on top?
What do you mean, who's coming out on top?
Well, because all these investment groups, that's going to be sooner or later, one guy is going to be the guy that's going to run. Well, it looks like it's going to be Magic Johnson. Yeah, but you don't know, man.
Well, I mean, Robert's making a good point. He's got Magic Johnson right now is the leader of this group of investors. My understanding is he has a minority stake, but then they probably all have a minority stake. But he is the visible public face of this group that is bidding to buy the Dodgers. They have been picked by Major League Baseball. I think Major League Baseball would like to see this happen. And now it simply has to go to some kind of a hearing scheduled for April the 13th. On the other side of the news, we'll get into this a little bit more thoroughly as we continue here on the world-famous Phil Henry Show on this Tuesday night. At our number, 877-876-7445. Don't forget our website, philhenryshow.com. Get a backstage pass. Watch our live streaming video of the show. Listen to the archives and become a part of our BSP family.
He's got pepper. He's got power.
Phil Henry.
Boy, that's lousy.
From the shores of El Pacifico, Phil Henry.
Welcome back here to the world-famous Phil Henry Show. What are you looking up, bud?
I'm trying to spell it out.
You're an idiot. It's not spelled like that. How many times I got to tell you?
Well, you're crazy.
I'm telling you, Kraftwerk is spelled K-R-A-F-T-W-E-R-K.
Damn, I'm a kind of spelled German style. What?
It's not spelled W-O-R-K. They spell it the way the Germans spell work, W-E-R-K. We're having a discussion about Kraftwerk being, if you remember the group Kraftwerk, Kraftwerk has been alluded to by a great many of the early, of the founding fathers of hip-hop and rap. They've pointed to Kraftwerk as a group that was very inspirational. Now, the irony of this is astounding, given the fact that Kraftwerk is a group from Germany, a techno group from Germany, if you will. And this group from Germany a nation that was the birthplace of this philosophy of the super Aryan race, destroyed in a world war, rebuilding itself out of the ashes as the matrix of American hip hop. The irony, the poetry, the colossal historical significance of that. I mean, it just ain't big enough, you know.
Now, on a scale, you talk about, don't you get them at all these white boys? They're the ones that gave a lot of inspiration to black people.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that formed, the foundational elements of hip-hop, but because American jazz has a lot to do with that. I remember going to jazz concerts way back in the day, when it was a sax player and a drummer and somebody on congas, and there's somebody up there. Poetry readings, you know. I mean, if you want to get right down to it, the poetry readings of the Beatniks, where they were being accompanied by a jazz sax player. You don't think so?
Man, I don't know, you know. That sounds like a lot of white people stuff, you know.
A lot of white people stuff? I'm telling you, a lot of these shows that I saw, these were black artists. It was black jazz, you know.
Yeah, but most of the Beatniks was white.
There were black beatniks, but yeah, I suppose the white beatniks, I guess, were trying to be what the black jazz musicians already were. Now, let me just don't talk anymore, because I got to find this stupid thing, bud. Now that you downloaded the thing, I don't know where it is.
It's under Kraftwerk, spelled K-R-A-N.
I know how it's spelled. So here it is. This is the song. This is one of them. Trans. What the hell is this called, man?
That's what the people like Africa Mombasa and them in New York, you know, listen to this.
Africa who?
Africa Bambasso. Nah, man, Mombasso.
Mombasso or?
Nah, it's Africa Bambasso.
Will you shut up, bud?
You don't know what a man's name is?
I don't get it, man. How is this like inspiring hip-hop?
I don't know.
Well, anyway, I remember this album because I played the song that we played when I was in Album Rock Radio.
Yeah, just turn it up a little bit so I can hear it. I want a groove to it. Yeah. 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 I can see how they do that.
All right, fine. Turn it down, man. That's a song called, by the way, if you call that a song, it's called Trans-Europe Express by Kraftwerk. So what do you think of that, bud, huh?
Yeah, I think it's pretty interesting how that everything is done.
Well, I mean, a culture is something that is shared. And cultures influence other cultures, and the next thing you know, you've got a whole new thing that happens, and it's impossible, absolutely impossible, to think of the world as a place that stays static in terms of race and culture. If we look at the human race, and the fact that we're the most adaptable creatures on Earth because we go places. What do? We go places. We go to the North Pole. We go to the South Pole. We travel to this continent and that continent. Human beings are constantly on the move. And we're always looking to see about this. And then we want to go over here and look at that. And then we want to go down here and look at this. And it's impossible to think of humans as something anything other than a very migratory species. We're always moving and we're always adapting, which means that we borrow and we use, and that's been the history of the human race. There's only been two things. I've already told you guys about one that have spontaneously, well, I shouldn't say. Well, I think I will. There's only two things that have spontaneously developed in humankind. Actually, only two places that have spontaneously developed writing, which was, I mentioned, Mexico and the Middle East. All other cultures on Earth used what is called either the blueprint or they cloned or copied directly. There's writing, and then there is farming, which developed spontaneously in, I think, the Middle East and maybe one other place. And all the other places, they learned it by migrating humans, saying, hi, how are you doing? Well, I'm fine. Well, see this stuff? Yeah, we plant it. We don't go running around the globe looking for it. Oh, that's interesting. Here, why don't you try it? Okay, thanks. Goodbye. Bye.
Like Johnny Appleseed or something like that. Maybe that's when I started.
Johnny Appleseed? No, well, I don't know.
Well, that's exactly what Johnny Appleseed did. You know, if you look up Johnny Appleseed, he take the Appleseed.
What? Johnny Appleseed?
Yeah, he taught people how to go to Apple.
No, he didn't, man. I don't even know what Johnny Appleseed was. Didn't he dump a bunch of apple seeds, right?
Yeah.
Well, what's that got to do with teaching people how to grow an apple, man? He just dumped a bunch of... What the hell was he doing anyway?
I don't know. going around growing up an apple. If you got what he did with Johnny Appleton, took a seed. Then
how did his name get to be Johnny Appleton all of a sudden?
That's how names evolve.
Are you guys messing with me or something?
No, Johnny Appleton. Well, I don't know. I don't know what he's saying.
Well, if you're saying Johnny Appleseed, Johnny Appleton.
Johnny Appleseed. What do you mean, Johnny Appleton? Johnny Appleseed.
There ain't no name like Appleseed. I'm trying to think of how that name developed.
Who cares, man? There ain't no guy named Johnny Appleseed. How did the name develop? That ought to be something. Why don't you look that up, bud? See if there's actually a human being on the face of the earth, and would have to be Anglo-Saxon or some English-speaking culture. Is there anybody with the last name Appleseed? Check that one out.
That's what I'm saying, Harry. That's why I said Appleton. Devil, how do you know that's the way the name went?
How do you know that Appleton came out of Appleseed?
That's the evolution.
You don't know that. That's if there was anybody named Appleseed. I don't know how the hell we got off on this. I was telling you guys about the adaptability of the human species, and the next thing I know, you got me talking about Johnny Appleseed. But the fact is, it was writing and farming. But anyway, humans learn from other humans. That's what we do. We learn from other human beings. We teach each other things. We don't do it because we're necessarily filled with the milk of human kindness. We trade. That's what the human race did. Well, you got what I want, and I got something you want. Here, you take that. Thanks. See you later. Bye. Go back beyond the mountains where you belong. Get out of here. Okay? So, you're talking about the music of Kraftwerk making its way to New York and being listened to by this group of young African-American musicians, influenced by R&B, influenced by jazz, years of listening to Motown, rock and roll. Now they hear this, and it's something that they take the whatever sensibility they had listening to jazz and R&B, and they say, I can use this, apply this spoken word thing that was happening with poetry to jazz and put it to something different, you know.
What do you mean, like from jazz?
Yeah, so they're not doing some rap, you know. It's not just a poetry reading to jazz music. Now all of a sudden, it's its own percussion instrument. The word. So I don't even want to get into it because I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. All I know is that those guys were a significant thing.
Yeah, they look like freaks too. What are you talking about? Just because they're white? No, the way they cut their hair.
Well, they look like weird asses. There's no question about it. I don't know if you want to go as far as to say they look like freaks the way they cut their hair.
Yeah, pretty weird though.
Anyway, the group was Kraftwerk, and that's what they done did, baby. All right, it's News and Information Hour here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show. We want to talk a little bit about Magic Johnson and the group that he leads buying the Dodgers and other stuff here on the world-famous Phil Hendry Show and philhendryshow.com. Get your backstage pass, watch our live-streaming video cast, listen to the archives, become educated, get a BSP, get your podcast, get with it, baby. We'll be right back.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Hendry Show.
Yeah!
This is the world-famous Phil Hendry Show.
Little homage tonight to Kraftwerk. Watching on Phil TV and HD, you see the group there from the 70s, and they bore no resemblance to anything having to do with the 70s. They look more like they'd be right at home right now. They have the hair, they got that whole Gary Numan vibe, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to say it looked like Gary Numan had done that song.
Yeah, remember that song, Cars in Cars, doo-doo, 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 driving my car, and then I'm in on the street. We're doing that.
You have to sing a song, man.
Yeah, we don't need to hear the whole thing, bud, but I know the song you're talking about. Yeah, they're, it was part of that sort of techno. It was the late 70s, early 80s. The Europeans, like the Japanese, so traumatized by war and the amazement, the amazing things that America had given to them, you know, because of the gloriousness of our culture, that it blew their European and Japanese minds. And out of it came Godzilla and plastic hair.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
What?
I don't know what I'm talking about. All right, so there you go. Kraftwerk, fantastic. All right, now, let's get on to something else, man, because this is creeping me out, all this Kraftwerk talk. No, they're good, you know, as far as it goes. A group led by Magic Johnson, the Lakers Hall of Famer, whose championship lineage and community involvement have made him one of the most beloved of sports figures. Where are my glasses, bud?
I don't know.
Made him one of the most beloved of sports figures. They have purchased or are interested in purchasing and have been given the Los Angeles Dodger bid. He will be the next owner, selected Tuesday, of the Dodgers. The Dodgers made the announcement Tuesday night. The Associated Press reported the winning bid was for $2 billion, which nearly doubles the record amount of $1.1 billion paid for a sports franchise by Stephen Ross for the NFL's Miami Dolphins in 2009. Wow, that's I didn't know the Dolphins went for $1 billion. Where have I been? You know,
you probably think Wayne Huizenga still own them.
Yeah, I do. My mind has been on other things, man. I don't know. The decision all but caps 3 years of turmoil surrounding the team, during which the Dodgers descended into mediocrity as Frank McCourt spent more than $25 million in a futile fight to retain ownership in an auction under the auspices of the U.S. Bankruptcy Court. McCourt chose the Johnson Group over the St. Louis Rams owner Stan Kroenke. I don't know how you pronounce that guy's name, excuse me. And a partnership of hedge fund billionaire Stephen Cohen and biotech billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong. Boy, that sounds suspect, doesn't it?
Yeah, that sounds weird.
Are you kidding me? A partnership of a hedge fund guy. If there's anything that makes people want to retch, it's just the words hedge fund. Whether or not we know what we're talking about, just the sound of that alone.
Yeah, hi, I run a hedge fund, and this guy is from Mongolia, and he builds, computers.
Nah, that doesn't sound like baseball to me. I could be wrong. If the deal closes as expected, the Dodgers would be owned by an entity called Guggenheim Baseball Partners.
What?
Well, that's the group of, speaking of hedge funds, no, it's actually the group that put the financing together for this thing. That would be the name of the entity. These are Guggenheim Baseball Partners. Guggenheim is the company that put the funding together, and the baseball partners part of that would be Guggenheim and Magic Johnson and a number of other people, which includes Stan Kasten, the former president of the Braves and the Washington Nationals, who's expected to wind up as the team's day-to-day top day-to-day executive. Stan Kasten is a phenomenal baseball executive who was behind the ascendancy of the Atlanta Braves through the 90s. Mark Walder, chief executive officer of the financial service firm Guggenheim Partners, who would become the controlling owner. All of a sudden, I don't like this.
Why?
What does that mean? He'll be the controlling owner. So he's the majority guy. So what's Magic Johnson got to do with it? You know, I hope this isn't one of these things where they're telling him, you know, Magic, yeah, sure, you're our guy. They're going to pull the rug out from underneath him. I'm smelling it already.
Wait a minute. What are you all of a sudden? Why don't you give him a chance?
Because I've seen this stuff before. I'm telling you, I've seen these partnerships. Everybody's one happy family, and then they finally get into the deal, and somebody's going to buy someone out. They're not going to have all of these guys involved in this group. Somebody, there's going to be a number of them who are going to want to get bought out. And there's going to be at least one guy who's going to want to buy everybody out. And I just hope it ain't some guy who's the chief executive officer of Guggenheim Partners, if you'll pardon me for saying.
But you want to be Magic.
I guess, yeah. It's the reason why I thought it was a pretty good thing in the first place. We all know the name. We know that Magic Johnson, in his own right, is a successful businessman. We know that he knows the L.A. sports market. He knows he knows sports. He certainly is familiar with the climate and the fan base here, and so on and so forth. So, you know, and he knows about fans. I mean, look at when he was a player, he knew how to keep the customer satisfied, baby. That was why Magic Johnson, one of the reasons why he was so popular, he knew how to play to the crowd. All right. The next guy on the list here of partners, Peter Guber, Warriors co-owner and chief executive of Mandalay Entertainment, who declined to comment when contacted at Tuesday night's Warriors game. Guber and Johnson are partners in Minor League Baseball's Dayton Dragons and have small stakes in the Dodgers already. Goober's also a Hollywood guy, I think, like a producer or something. The bulk of the funding to buy the Dodgers came from Guggenheim Partners, a Chicago-based financial services firm, but Walter's not expected to play a day-to-day role. Then why is he called the controlling owner? Not expected. You better have that in writing, Jack, and any guy that's a controlling owner is not going to give away anything.
Yeah, well, you're all excited about it now, man. What, did you change your mind?
Yeah.
Maybe I will change my mind. So what? So what if I do? Anyway, the sale must be confirmed by the court in a hearing on April the 13th. The transaction is set to close by April the 30th, which just so happens to be the same day that Mr. McCourt must pay his ex-wife $131 million in a divorce settlement. So the money is due, and by all indications, things going swimmingly, as they must, it'll all get tidied up by the 30th, and then that money is transferred to her, and I guess that's the end of the road for Frank McCourt. Now, here's the other part of this that's fascinating. As part of the agreement, the Dodgers said McCourt and certain affiliates of the purchasers, that means that Frank McCourt and then agents, or, well, they're calling them affiliates, so they are individuals who have a business or are in business with the people that are buying the Dodgers, but it isn't the people that are buying the Dodgers. These are affiliates of theirs. They and Frank McCourt, who's a third party here, they will acquire the land surrounding Dodger Stadium, including its parking lots, for $150 million.
What for?
Because the parking is where it's at. Frank McCourt, I know he wanted that parking. So here's what they said, obviously. McCourt wanted that parking. I had no idea that parking, in a day and age of television contracts, TV contracts, and the enormous merchandising deals that they do, I had no idea that parking was still worth as much as they, you know, say that it is, but, you know, far be it from me. But here's the thing. Obviously, the people buying the Dodgers said, well, we don't want Frank McCourt to own outright all of the parking, so we want to have our hand in that as well. We don't want to be involved in that, so we have, quote, affiliates of the purchasers. Okay, so that, what is an affiliate? It's somebody who's in business with. You're not the purchasers themselves, but you're in business with Magic Johnson and Caston and the rest of those guys. Frank McCourt has agreed to take them in as partners for this land that they're purchasing. That is Dodger Stadium parking. McCourt paid $430 million in 2004 to buy the team, Dodger Stadium, and 250 acres of land that included the parking lots from the Fox division of Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, a sale that left the team with about $50 million in cash at the time. The team's debt stood at $579 million as of January, according to a court filing. So that means that they not only are buying the ball club for $2 billion, but they got to wipe that debt out. Because ain't no sale takes place until all of that debt is dealt with.
So that means it costs $2.5 billion.
Yeah.
Or maybe they're including that. It's quite possible that that's included in the price there. So there it is. The Dodgers purchased by Magic Johnson. So now that we see here the a couple of the particulars of this thing, that the actual controlling of the actual controlling of the Dodgers business will be done by this guy, Walter. He is, quote, the chief executive. He will become the controlling owner. Does that mean he has a majority stake? I don't know. We'll find out. Anyway, I like the idea that Magic Johnson's involved in the deal. The rest of these guys, I could care less.
Doesn't sound too good anymore, does it?
Whatever. It's the world-famous Phil Henry Show. We'll be right back.
This is the world famous Phil Hendry Show.
It is the world-famous Phil Henry Show here every night till 1 o'clock on the West Coast and 4 a.m. on the East Coast, the news, talk, and entertainment show that knows what it's talking about. Reports Newt axes his staff, but he pledges to stay in the race. Well, that's very encouraging. That's very encouraging if you're a Newt Gingrich fan. That's very encouraging if you're a Newt Gingrich voter. Or maybe it's not. I don't know what that means, you know.
What's it mean?
It means he fired everybody, but he's staying in the race. It means that he's expecting a miracle. That's what it means. It means that he's saying, I can't afford to keep a staff. I can't afford to do much of anything. But I'm staying in the race because, well, I'm staying in the race because I want my voice heard. Well, Newt, I think your voice has been heard, man.
Did they keep on talking that same stuff he's talking?
Yeah, he just wants to keep on yakking that same jazz he's been yakking, which was discredited a long time ago by Romney in that debate where Gingrich thought that he'd pulled out the stops and really caught Romney with his hand in the cookie jar talking about his investments in Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and then Romney turned it around on him and said, well, guess what, Jack, that's where your money is too. Romney saw that coming like 3 days out. That's what I think convinced a lot of people, myself included, that Gingrich thought that he was just God's gift to the world of brains. He thought that there wasn't anything anybody could pull out on him that he couldn't deal with. And Romney was way ahead of him. Way ahead of him. Anyway, Newt Gingrich's floundering campaign announced a major shakeup last night, including the departure of a top operative, but insisted it was staying the course all the way to the convention. Woo! Gingrich laid off one-third of his staff and replaced campaign manager Michael Krull with longtime aide Vince Haley. The drastic changes come as Gingrich languishes in third place in most delegate counts, behind frontrunner Mitt Romney and the other frontrunner, Rick Santorum, who ain't that much of a frontrunner either. Pundits have long believed that Santorum would have a better shot at toppling Romney if Gingrich dropped out, allowing the conservative base to unite around a single candidate, and then that way they could split it evenly down the middle and make sure that Obama wins the election in November. But those conservatives have such a very, very important message, they just simply must get it said, even if it means they lose another presidential race. Jeez.
Yeah, but what do you expect them to do if they really believe in it and everything like that?
Okay, fine. Well, then maybe people ought to get smart. Maybe people on the Republican side ought to get smart. Here's what they got to say. The conservatives over there have more juice and more pull than the progressive, the really super liberals on the Democratic side. The super liberals on the Democratic side, which I guess you could say is like their Tea Party, you know, the progressives, way progressives. Those cats are like the Tea Party of the Democratic Party, but they got no pull. They got nobody's paying any attention to them. No serious Democrat pays any attention to them. You can see how much attention Obama's paying to them when he talks about Guantanamo staying open and the Patriot Act getting extended. He could care less. Okay?
No, they say he owes them.
Oh, he owes them. My ass, he owes them. Obama won that election, and Obama knows why he won that election, because he got the middle-of-the-road people, man. He got a lot of those independents, a lot of those people, well, I could vote Democrat, I could vote Republican, I don't know. He got the Main Street USA people. That's who he got. He owes them.
They're the ones who went out, got out to vote and everything and walked around and stuffed envelopes and stuff.
What are you guys doing anyway? You just talking just to hear yourselves talk? Is this stuff that you hear on TV?
Yeah, that's what they were saying the other day.
Well, quit quoting crap you hear on TV.
Sound like you were choking there, man. God, man, what you been eating?
Hey, watch it, okay? What I've been eating. Anyway, pundits have long believed that Santorum would have a better chance. Yeah, sure. Sure he would.
You don't think he'd have a better chance without Gingrich?
Have a better chance at what? Have a better chance at being in second? He'd have a much stronger second place showing? Yeah, that's what he'd have a better chance at. Man, I've seen these guys on TV, these Republican heavy hitters, you know, these talking heads. A lot of these guys that are, I would say that they represent sort of the brain trust or the I don't know, man. The grown-up part of... There's a word from that movie, that Tinker Tailor, whatever, where they used to say, come see the grown-ups.
Yeah.
That's the grown-ups in the Republican Party. I think that... I think those people think it's Romney all the way. And they think that this dalliance with Santorum and Gingrich, enough is enough, and they want to get rid of those two clowns, and they want to get it going. Now, we've seen this before, and I can tell you, in the lead-up to elections... It's generally thought that if a party is not united coming out of a convention, they're going to get their ass kicked. Now, I remember that the Democrats coming out of 76, they looked beautiful. They loved Jimmy Carter. He was a beautiful thing. Meanwhile, you had Watergate. You had Ford. It was a disaster. And it was still close. That's what a lot of people don't remember. They don't, everybody looks back in the 70s and Nixon was a disaster, this and that. But that election in 76 was really close, man. You had Ford, who, to be honest with you, and people will say what they want to say. But I know, and I'm telling you the objective facts of the 1976 election, Ford was on his way to making people forget, at least forget in the short haul, all the damage that had been done by Watergate. And the Nixon presidency, and Ford was beginning to make his mark. And by the by election time, it could have gone either way. It wasn't a slam dunk for Carter at all. Now, and that was the Republicans coming out of that. Or excuse me, the Democrats coming out of that convention all united. Now comes 80, and the Democrats are shot to hell. The Republicans have got a little bit of a fight because that was it. Bush? Is it Reagan? Is it? Well, it never was going to be Bush. Ronald Reagan was the man. And he came out of that convention, he was the man. I remember they were thinking about having Bush as the, was it George Bush as being the co-presidency? They were going to have some co-presidency, remember that? But in any event, Reagan was the man. So now here comes this convention, and Santorum and Gingrich have muddied things so much that the Republicans may come out of that convention not really all that united, they may still look like a bunch of stumble bums with Santorum yakking his stuff, whatever it is, no one cares. Gingrich yakking his stuff, whatever it is, no one cares. And people just looking at the Republicans going, you know what, they still got their head up their rear ends. I'm voting for Obama.
But you gotta do.
If Romney's the nominee, I might vote for Romney, and I'll tell you why. I think I think we needed President Obama when we had him. I think we needed to inject this country with that kind of thinking and that kind of approach to problems. We did. I don't think there was anything wrong with that. I think it was. I may vote for Romney because I think, now's the time to perhaps adjust a little bit. I like the fact that Romney was the author of a health plan in Massachusetts.
Yeah, you don't sound like you know what you're talking about.
Why don't you shut up?
What are you talking about, man?
What do you mean, what am I talking about? You guys asked me who I'm voting for, right?
Yeah, you gotta sound like you know what you're talking about.
I know what I'm talking about. Who are you voting for?
Nobody.
So you know what you're talking about, huh?
Yeah, I know exactly what I'm talking about. I ain't voting for nobody.
Me neither.
Oh, okay, so you guys are smarter than me, huh?
Way smarter. I ain't voting for none of these guys, and I mean it. These guys are stumble bum.
Well, okay, that's the difference between me and you guys.
You're all talking about, I might vote for Romney and I might vote for Obama.
Okay, fine.
On second thought. On second thought, ladies and gentlemen, I think I might vote for Romney and I might vote for Obama. Both of them. I might vote for both those guys, even if they get the law.
Very funny.
That's what you sound like.
I'm telling you that I gave you as honest an answer as I could, okay? If you don't like it, then you don't like it.
Well, let's start crying.
I ain't crying.
Yeah. Gonna vote for Romney. I don't know why you're voting for the guy. Otherwise, so you're gonna vote for Obama.
Why aren't you gonna vote for Obama?
Who's Obama?
I said Obama.
Because I think now's the time to bring back a little financial sense to things, okay? Maybe I think now's the time to start, reining it in a little bit. Because maybe I think that Romney, at least with Romney, you got a conservative when it comes to the economy, but also a guy that's enough of a pragmatist to have put together a health care plan for the people of Massachusetts, because he recognizes the impact that that kind of expense has on an economy. So he's not a dyed-in-the-wool philosophical conservative no matter what, even if it's a bad idea. I don't like guys like that. You got to be able to, you got to be flexible, man. You got to use what you can use. Whatever works, works. You know?
Yeah, so why don't you just vote for Obama? Because that's what he's doing.
Maybe I still will vote for Obama. Boy, you guys crack me up with that, man. You can't pronounce the word. You think you know all about the guy. You can't pronounce his name.
I said Obama.
No, you didn't. You said Obama. All right, coming back here at a world-famous Phil Henry show, more news from our news sources. Looks like that, what's her name, Martina Navratilova, she got her ass booted off of Dancing with the Stars. You want to know why?
She's a lesbian.
Exactly. I'm kidding. No, it's because she sucks when she dances. And other news, it's the world-famous Phil Henry Show and philhenryshow.com. Check it out, man. Our backstage pass and our live-streaming video of the show each and every night. We'll be right back.
Truth is our bitch. The Phil Henry Show.
Yeah, how fat are you today?
What do you mean, how fat am I today?
Well, I'm on the diet.
Yeah, I know. You can ask me, how's the diet come? You have to say, how fat are you today?
Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah, the diet's coming great, bud. Thanks for asking. How fat am I today? I'll tell you this much. I lost 5 pounds last week.
Yeah, I told my aunt about that, man. That's pretty damn good.
That's, you know, it is pretty good. It is pretty good. But here's the thing. You know, my metabolism, you know, when your metabolism changes, it speeds that weight loss up at the beginning. But then your body catches up to what's going on. There's that old thing about, watch Bud will start asking all kinds of questions.
But you always think I'm stupid.
I don't think you're, why do I think you're, I don't think you're stupid. You're always asking dumb stuff. The time I said that the body thinks that it's in a famine, you're going, hey, your body can't think.
Yeah, well, you talk about your body thinking stuff.
All I'm trying to say is the metabolism changes. Then when the metabolism finally gets the idea, I'm sorry, I don't know any other way of putting it, bud. When your body's metabolism gets the idea, oh, we're not eating as much food, that means we're not getting as much food, so I better hold on to the fat. That's what happens biochemically to the body. It starts holding on to the fat because it believes that there's some kind of a famine going on. So what you have to do then is you have to increase, obviously, your exercise. They also say that you need to return to a normal form of eating for maybe a day just to kind of shake things up a little bit. I don't subscribe to that thinking, man. I've lost weight before, and I didn't do any of that jazz. So I was just talking to Dan about these Starbucks, man.
Well, I went out and got you like those full fat cafe latte.
Yeah, well, we ain't doing that no more, man. Because these 20 ounce cafe lattes from Starbucks, these suckers are 339 calories.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding. 339 calories, man. If I drink two of those a day, which I can easily do. Okay, so what are we talking about? We're talking about 700 calories, let's say, and I'm only eating 2,000. That's almost half, man, of what I'm consuming, what I should be consuming in a day. I'm drinking with coffee? Forget it.
What about them two chocolate bars you have, man? You didn't even count them.
What are you doing, man? Leaning over my shoulder and counting everything?
Yeah, there's another one. See these? I got these wrappers.
Yeah, look. Here the wrappers. Give me those wrappers. Are you guys collecting wrappers?
Yeah. I found the wrappers yesterday from the chocolate bars you ate.
Yeah, man. That's 200 more calories you want to count. You guys are going behind me and collecting wrappers?
Yeah, here's another one.
Yeah. Give me that, man. You ain't taking any wrappers from me.
Are you going to count them or not?
I thought I did count them.
That's 200 calories, man.
All right, I'll count the 200 calories. I don't give a damn. What do you guys think? You're punishing me or not? It's fine. Okay, so that's 200 calories. So I'm starting today, March 28th, Wednesday. I'm starting with 369.5 calories, 169.5, because the only coffee I had left was this latte, which I'm drinking right now.
You going to drink that whole thing?
I'm probably not going to drink the whole thing, no.
But I'm drinking half. Let's just say I'm drinking half of this thing, man. It's 169 calories right there. I'm just knocking 169 calories into my Wednesday, plus those 200 calories because you busybody, nosy jackballs are telling me that I'm eating, chocolate bars, and I didn't think I was eating chocolate bars. Okay, fine. So that's 369 calories. I don't care. Good. All right. But in any event, you know, this is cool, man, and I'll tell you why it's cool. Because I got something to look forward to now, man. This summer is going to be a good summer. You know, I'm going to have for the first time since before I got married, I may get it down to, a reasonable weight here.
How much did you, what's the skinniest what you've ever been?
As an adult?
Yeah, as an adult. How skinny you been?
As an adult, when I was 28 years old, I was 100. I was not. I was not. This was not a healthy weight for me. I was 145 pounds. I was 6 feet tall. That was me not eating. I wasn't sick, but I was living on coffee and cigarettes. I remember I was a music director in Miami, and I was working at WSHE in Miami, and I'd taken over the music director job there. And I just jumped into this gig like a maniac, man. I jumped into this music director gig like a maniac. I was there every morning at 6. Now, keep in mind, I had an air shift to do. So I had to be on the air at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, go to 2 to 6 doing an air shift. And I was at the station at 6 a.m. every morning, dubbing off music, putting music into the library. Then I had to see the record people, and then I had to do an air shift. My office was a freaking disaster.
But did you said you didn't like meeting record people.
No, that was the part of the gig I didn't like at all. I'm not a social guy. And the part of the music director job that I did not like was I didn't mind meeting the record promotion people. They're fine. They're nice guys, and they have a record they want to promote, and I'm happy to sit down and listen to it, and I'm happy to talk to them. But this was the 70s, and so sometimes you'd have somebody come into your office, and they got a jar of Coke, or they have a little bottle of Coke.
Man, that sounds like heaven.
Oh, does it now? Well, it wasn't.
No, I mean for back then.
No, not for me, it wasn't.
Did you do any drugs?
I wasn't doing any drugs at that time. I wasn't doing any drugs. I wasn't drinking. I wasn't doing any drugs at all. I had this music director job. I had my girlfriend, and that's it. My life was about as dull. My life's always been dull. From the time I was like, it's always been a dull life. I've always been a working guy, and then I go home, and that's what it was when I was in my 20s. I mean, when I was, if I didn't have a girlfriend, I was out drinking and partying and doing, what I did. But if I had any domesticity in my life, if there was a female in my life, it was always, you could ask any one of them that ever knew me. It was always like, oh, let's go home and watch TV. Okay. Or something else.
Yeah, dump back.
Well, so I had this music director gig, and I'm up at 6, and I'm doing this gig, and then came the record promotion guys. Well, finally, the cat that was our program director at the time said it to me in no uncertain terms. He said, you got to start hanging out with these record guys, man. I want us to have a relationship with these record companies, and I want you to go out and hang with them, because I guess they complained that I wasn't hanging with them. That I wasn't going out partying, that I wasn't going to concerts, that I wasn't going to shows. And this is the kind of square, stupid guy that I've always been. I've always been this guy. I thought, well, why do I got to go to a concert or a show to know whether a record sounds good on our format or not? You know, why do I got to go to a concert or a show to know whether or not I'm going to add the Elton John album? Of course I'm going to add the Elton John album. You know? I didn't have to go to a concert or a show when Dire Straits came. I said, we got to put the Dire Straits on our station because it sounded great. You know? But that was the game, so.
Yeah, well, that's when you quit, right?
I did quit, and I left Miami, and I came to Los Angeles back in the late 70s when I was still a disc jockey, when I was still in music radio. So that was the history of my life right there. But I was 145 pounds then, and my ideal weight is around 200. I'm 6 feet tall, so it probably should be, probably around 200, 210, and that's ideal. And I got a long way to go, man, before I hit that. But I can do it, and I can do it by midsummer. And with God's help and yours, and with the help of the United States Army and our affiliated military branches, by God we will.
Bill Hendry will no longer be a fat ass.
Yes. Glory, hallelujah.
Thank you. Now, what do you mean, no longer a fat ass? Get out of here.
The world-famous Phil Hendry Show is produced by Dan Northcraft and Phil Hendry. Don't forget, our website is philhendryshow.com. This is where you can get yourself your backstage pass, baby. And, you know, check out all of the marvelous and amazing things we have for you there at philhendryshow.com. Until tonight, later and greater, this is Phil Hendry for Bud Dickman.
Hey.
And Robert Leonard.
Bye.
Phil Hendry.